You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump announced yesterday he'll send federal law enforcement agents to five cities in an effort to address violence. According to an announcement from the White House, Milwaukee will be among them. We'll talk about that announcement and what local leaders have said about the move. First, Wisconsin researchers are running experiments to better understand how the new coronavirus functions. They're using animal models and research on other contagious diseases to try to figure out how to prevent COVID-19. Peter Halfman is a scientist at UW-Madison who works with influenza and Ebola, among other diseases. He isn't directly developing a possible coronavirus vaccine, but he's a lead researcher in the lab that is. He talked with WPR host Keely Boltina about the latest scientific work on the new coronavirus.
What do we know about mutation and this new coronavirus?
Right now, there's not a lot of mutations occurring that now have distinguished a certain strain of coronavirus from the original strain. So there's not a lot of mutation going on that we know for sure is changing transmissibility or pathogenicity of the virus.
We battle this every year with influenza as scientists do their best to determine which strains of flu are most likely to take hold, and then we inevitably miss some. Does this new coronavirus mutate differently than influenza, or does it just not really do it?
Well, the difference here is that with flu, we put some immune pressures on the virus because we get vaccinated. So the virus wants to try to escape that. Now, right now, with coronavirus, we don't have a vaccine yet, so it's a novel virus to us. There's not a lot of selective pressure going on, and that's why we're really not seeing this kind of divergence of different strains occurring.
When it comes to technology of developing a vaccine, then, how are we using what we know about influenza to help us with the new coronavirus?
So our group in particular has come up with a technique to make influenza virus artificially. We're using that technique, which is called reverse genetics, to kind of modify the flu backbone, and we are inserting a coronavirus protein, the spike protein, which our immune system recognizes, into that flu backbone. So then we'll have a single replication competent influenza virus modified to express the coronavirus protein, and that way we can make a vaccine that will hopefully protect people from both influenza virus and this new coronavirus.
Is it possible that we might not actually be able to develop a vaccine against the virus that causes COVID-19?
We will. The thing to remember is that these first vaccines are going to come out, you know, hopefully by the end of this year, early of next year, most likely not going to be the best vaccines. We're kind of using technologies we've had in place for other vaccines, and we're kind of implementing with this coronavirus vaccine. So they might not be the best at first, and that's where we have to look at the data from the clinical trials, kind of go back and modify our vaccine a bit to kind of give a better boost to the immune system. And when I say they're not the best, it's going to be a vaccine that you're going to have to get a prime immunization and then a boost immunization, and maybe even a third immunization to be completely protective. So we kind of want to modify these vaccines down the road so that they only require one vaccination, and that will help reduce the amount of vaccines we need to make for the world.
Then how long could it take for us to develop a safe, effective vaccine?
We should be getting a vaccine out hopefully the first or second quarter of 2021. We did an Ebola virus vaccine here in this lab that is in clinical trials right now, and that took us 5 years to develop. You're definitely looking at a time frame in a normal situation that could take up to 5 years, and we're trying to condense this down to 1 year. So there's a lot of hurdles to do that, and any kind of little issue along this pipeline could add, you know, several months to this process. The nice thing is that there's over 100 coronavirus vaccine candidates that are in different phases of development. I think the last count, there was at least 17 that are in human trials. So the nice thing here is we have a whole world of collaborators and researchers working on this. So if there's a hiccup in one vaccine, we definitely have some fallback.
Peter Haffman is a research associate professor at UW-Madison. We're talking about research happening here in Wisconsin as labs rush to understand the new coronavirus and figure out how to fight it. This is the Ideas Network. Peter, what have we found out about animal transmission and the new coronavirus?
We were hearing stories several months ago about human transmitting the virus to cats, and that's kind of something that we became interested in with our research, and it showed that once a cat was infected, it easily transmitted the virus to naive cats. And the cats in our study were healthy, and they never, besides having coronavirus, they were healthy. And they never showed any signs of illness. So there is definitely the possibility of some domestic animals like cats, and now we're hearing dogs getting infected with this virus. So they could serve as a minor reservoir for this virus or intermediate host for this virus. And that's something we should kind of keep an eye on.
And what you mean by that is that they might not have all of the effects, or it might not really like to live in animals, but they could transmit it to us as humans.
Easily transmitted to us, yeah. And there's definitely cases in the Netherlands where cats have become infected and have transmitted to humans.
Should we be concerned about wild animals here?
That should be looked into. Just like influenza virus, where there are wildlife animal reserves out there, this virus is sticking around for a long time, and it could easily mutate or adapt, and we could have a wildlife reservoir that we don't even know about. And that'll make trying to get this pandemic or get this virus under control a lot more difficult if that happens.
What have you found out about hamsters?
We developed a hamster model for infection, and this was mainly for using for vaccine and antiviral or countermeasure research. We need an animal model to test these vaccines and antiviral drugs. So we developed a hamster model. And we are aiming for an animal model that really recapitulated what was going on in humans. And the golden Syrian hamsters that we used had very high virus replication in their lungs, and only in the lungs, just like was happening in humans. And we see a lot of damage to the lungs because of infection, and we also see pneumonia in these lungs. So it's a great model to kind of look at vaccine development and antiviral development, because they really mimic the infections we see in humans.
We've heard a lot about antibodies. Can you talk some about plasma therapy? What is that?
Yeah, that was part of our hamster study too, and there's actually a study going on here at UW. It's a very old technique that people have used, that they ask people who have recovered from infection to donate blood. And then the cell parts of the blood is centrifuged out, leaving the plasma that's left. And inside that plasma are antibodies. And a portion of those antibodies are specific to the coronavirus, and they're actually called neutralizing antibodies. So these antibodies in this plasma from healthy people that have recovered from the virus can actually bind to the surface of the virus and don't let the virus get into your body and then protect you from infection.
What do we need to know next to figure out if that works when it comes to the virus that causes COVID-19?
So there are clinical studies going on, healthy people donating their plasma. In the lab, we can tell that the plasma from these people have really good antibodies in it that neutralize the virus. So now we'll need a couple months for clinical testing to see if this actually can be transferred from one person to another person, the plasma and the protection antibodies that are in that plasma. In the lab, we've done this with hamsters. We infected hamsters, let them recover from infection, and then took their plasma and transferred that to naive hamsters, infected them. And they were fairly well protected from the virus.
We've seen conspiracy theories, some fear about where and how this disease started. What do you make of the public's response and understanding of this virus right now?
That's a good question. Before we got into coronavirus research, our main research is actually with Ebola virus. We spent a good portion of 2 years in Sierra Leone and West Africa during that outbreak. And we hear the same thing, too, with Ebola virus, that, you know, it's something that's a lab that came out of a lab, that came out of a government. And now we actually have heard this in the United States from people, and it's discouraging. It might be the fact that people don't know people that have been infected or have been negatively affected by an infection. So we just hope that there's enough education out there for people to believe that this is not a conspiracy and that it should be taken serious. And I think by the numbers that we see here in the United States of the number of infections and records we're seeing in certain states for hospitalizations and deaths, that there really needs to be a push for public education on this virus.
Peter, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was researcher Peter Haffman talking with WPR host Keely Boltina. They discussed research here in Wisconsin on the virus that causes COVID-19 and how likely it is that scientists can develop an effective vaccine, and soon. Coming up, we'll learn about President Trump's move to send federal agents to cities across the country, including Milwaukee. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, Kenosha County is going to be one of the most closely watched counties in the presidential election. We'll talk with a reporter who spent 6 weeks asking people how they felt about the economy, their community, and politics. First, President Trump announced yesterday that he plans to send federal law enforcement agents to 5 U.S. cities, including Milwaukee. Trump argued that the move is necessary to stem the tide of what he says is rising violence in these cities. Federal agents have already been sent to Portland, Oregon. Since they've been in the city, we've seen clashes between federal forces and anti-police violence protesters. We've also heard allegations of these officers arresting people and removing them from the street in unmarked vehicles. State and local leaders have voiced their opposition to the move, saying that the decision seems political in nature and could make issues worse in cities like Milwaukee. Our next guest has been covering the story and joins us to give us the latest. Ashley Lutheran is an investigative journalist and covers public health and safety issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ashley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So in the news conference yesterday, President Trump didn't mention Milwaukee by name, but the White House did eventually say that Milwaukee is on the list. What's been the response to this news from city and state lawmakers?
So yesterday, the response from most state and city leaders in Milwaukee was one of confusion and concern. They wanted to know what exactly these federal agents would be doing in the city and what their orders would be. Today, we got some more clarity from our U.S. attorney here in Milwaukee, who was clarifying and echoing statements that actually our local district attorney, John Chisholm, made the day before, which is that this whole effort is actually a rebranding and continuation of an existing Justice Department initiative. It is something that is distinct and separate from what federal authorities are doing in Portland. For example, in Portland, those are Customs and Border Patrol officers who were deputized for the Federal Protective Service. So they were assigned to that city to protect federal property. In Milwaukee and these other cities, they're talking about using agents from the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, and U.S. Marshals, which is quite common as far as law enforcement collaboration. And we've seen those kinds of efforts here in Milwaukee before to address violent crime and specifically gun crime.
You refer to it as collaboration. That tends to sound like kind of an equal relationship. Is this something that Milwaukee police and Milwaukee leaders have asked for?
So initially, I think, again, a lot of this confusion stemmed from the way it was rolled out. And you explained that very well in your introduction about the White House announcement. And initially, there weren't very many details or explanation about what this was. And that caused a lot of confusion. The Milwaukee Police Department has come out and said very clearly that the department has not requested any help as it relates to policing any sort of protests or civil unrest, and that, in fact, they would, quote, respectfully decline federal agents for that purpose. However, the Milwaukee Police Department also said that they do partner with federal law enforcement frequently, and that they would continue to do so for that existing initiative, which used to be called Operation Relentless Pursuit and now is called Operation Legend. And so you're seeing more of a, you're seeing local and federal law enforcement today trying to make an even sharper distinction between those things and what's happening in Milwaukee and these other four cities, and contrasting that with what happened in Portland.
Governor Tony Evers sent a letter to the Trump administration asking them to hold off on sending federal agents. He also said this on a reporter call yesterday.
Amping up the federal presence will, I believe, create more turmoil.
Is that a concern, that actually the presence of these federal officers, regardless of what branch they're coming from, that this could actually escalate a situation?
I think that's a concern, and you heard some of that from Milwaukee's Common Council this morning. My colleague Allison Durr was reporting on that. There's certainly a concern that with just the timing and everything going on in the city with the DNC, which will still be happening, although it'll be mostly virtual, that, you know, an ongoing ongoing protest, that, you know, there were concern from local aldermen here saying, well, what's to kind of stop those federal resources from being redirected and perhaps being used in ways that they're not foreseeing or not planning for right now.
We're talking with Ashley Lutheran right now. She's an investigative journalist and covers public health and safety issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about the Trump administration's decision and announcement that they will be sending federal officers into several cities across the country, including Milwaukee. And what is the justification from the Trump administration for sending these federal law enforcement officers to cities like Chicago, Albuquerque, and Milwaukee?
So the justification that's been given is these resources are to be used to address violent crime. Milwaukee, like other cities around the country, has seen a surging homicide rate. In the city of Milwaukee, the homicides really started to spike in April. You started to see that trend emerging. And many of them, more than one third of them, are related to family or domestic violence. And so, you know, federal officials are saying these resources will be used to focus on illegal gun possession, tracing firearms, and working to solve violent crime in the hopes of preventing future violence.
And what do we know about the cities where they are saying that they'll be sending these federal agents? Are they generally Democratic cities? Are they cities that have higher crime rates than other cities? Are there commonalities to them?
So I think immediately one thing that's jumped out to observers and, of course, to our local officials here in Milwaukee is that it appears to be targeting Democratic cities. And so, of course, that was a concern. Some folks who have voiced criticism, you know, fear that this is, more of a political move rather than an effort for public safety.
And if I remember correctly, they are saying that some cities will see these agents arriving within the next week, but Milwaukee is on the schedule for, I believe, about 3 weeks from now. Is there a reason why Milwaukee is being focused on at that point instead of sooner if the problems are so serious?
That's something that we weren't able to get answered in our reporting. The White House hasn't really specified that. And in my discussion with the U.S. attorney, he continually said, you know, there will be more specific details forthcoming. And so you're correct. This operation is expected to expand into Chicago and Albuquerque, New Mexico next, and then we'll continue into Cleveland, Detroit, and Milwaukee over the next 3 weeks. I would anticipate that we'd be learning more in the next week or so about what that would look like from some of our local representatives who are part of the federal government, like the U.S. attorney.
Several of these cities where these agents are going to be sent have also seen calls for funding for police to be scaled back, redistributed to other social programs. That's certainly the case in Milwaukee. Does that also seem to be an element in this, because President Trump has come out very strongly against those calls for reform that take the form of defunding police or reapportioning funding?
Yes, absolutely. In the White House announcement yesterday and the recap of what the president said, it included a quote from him that essentially said, I don't want to defund the police. I want to add more police. And so as far as this initiative, it's not only sending more federal resources, but there's also supposed to be federal money used to hire more police officers. And as you rightfully point out, that comes amid discussion nationally and here in Milwaukee about reallocating resources from the police department into other areas and to other social services to try to address, what people see as the true root causes of crime and violence.
What have we heard from Wisconsin Republican leaders about this planned move of bringing federal agents?
Well, Senator Ron Johnson released a statement today in which he was saying, we should welcome federal resources to help reduce violent crime. He said that no one's talking about sending an occupying force, and it's disappointing that some are suggesting this is anything other than an effort to combat crime. Yesterday, there were some comments from another prominent State House Republican who was saying essentially, Milwaukee certainly needs this help because of the homicide rate that's going up this year. However, there's a real question of local control and were local officials adequately informed and did they ask for this? And if not, that's a problem.
Well, Ashley, thank you so much for joining us and bringing us up to speed.
Thank you for having me.
Ashley Lutheran is an investigative journalist and covers public health and safety issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us today to talk about the Trump administration's announcement that it plans to send federal law enforcement agents into several cities across the country, including Milwaukee. Coming up, we'll find out how people in Kenosha County are feeling about their local economy and civic life and what that could mean for the 2020 election. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday after 7:30 on The Morning Show, with a huge influx of applications for unemployment benefits in Wisconsin, wait times have been long and there have been incorrect payments made. The secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development joins Kate Archer Kent to discuss the situation now and what possible continuations of federal support are being considered. That's Monday morning after 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, so-called post-industrial areas in the Midwest have gotten a lot of attention since the 2016 election when they helped deliver a victory for Donald Trump. One of those areas is Kenosha County. Formerly the home of the American Motors Corporation and other big manufacturers, it was a center of union labor and a stronghold for Democrats, something the party hopes to regain after Republicans won the county 4 years ago. Our next guest spent 6 weeks in Kenosha this winter asking people how they felt about their local economy, civic life, and what energizes and frustrates them about politics. He found an attitude from many residents that's more complex than much of the media and a lot of political candidates might realize. James Pogue is a contributor to Harper's Magazine and author of the August cover story, The Art of Losing: Can Democrats Win Back Post-Industrial America? James, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, you start your piece by acknowledging something that a lot of us appreciate, that the, quote, coastal journalist visiting a Midwestern town to find out why Donald Trump won the last election is a pretty worn out trope by this point. You didn't want to do that. You didn't want to fall into that trap. What were you personally curious about when you came to Kenosha?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, I don't mention this in the piece, but I'm from southwestern Ohio, which is sort of like southeastern Wisconsin, a pretty key swing area in the country. And so I had seen people coming, I grew up in Cincinnati. I'd seen people come into Dayton, Ohio. It's a big one, like Youngstown, like Kenosha, a lot of these quote unquote post-industrial places where reporters have flown in and tried to divine something about why it is that a lot of these places flipped to Trump. And so what I was interested in was, staying for a little bit longer than a lot of these people are able to do. I'm young, I don't have kids, so I had the freedom to do that. And to try and divine something that went a little deeper than the kind of like angry white male rage explanation for how Donald Trump got elected, which I think is a big part of the confusion that Democrats have about how to go forward.
You really can't talk about southeastern Wisconsin without talking about labor unions. Union labor at plants like American Motors was behind a lot of the growth and real prosperity in the past for places like Kenosha and the people that called them home. Today, though, things are different. How did unions figure into people's thinking about the economy today?
Well, I think there's a really complicated conversation to have about what role unions played, not only in our economic life in terms of in helping people to ensure that they had a middle class way of existing in the 20th century, but also in our sort of social and civic ways of life, right? And so Kenosha is a really good example of a place where unions suffused all parts of the social fabric, not just people's economic lives. And not only did they help to have people, you know, be able to think, hey, I have security, I have a future, I have a future in this place, they helped bind people to the place. They helped make people feel at home, and they helped, you know, you would have parades, you would have social clubs, you would have all of these things that the unions were in a certain way a focal point for, right? And the reason that I think Kenosha is a really good example of forces that have buffeted people across the country is that Kenosha has a very clear example in the union of a social shaping civic force that has gone away, as many social shaping civic forces have gone away as our lives have become more disordered, more uncertain over the years. And so in a certain way, I think the unions are very specific to places, you know, in the industrialized North where they were very strong. But I also think that their departure from the fabric of our lives reflects something that's happened across the country.
I thought it was really interesting that as you were talking to young people who either, well, certainly weren't working in those union heydays, but maybe even don't have a personal memory of them, hear stories from their mothers, their fathers, their aunts, their uncles about what it was like then and how you could make a really good living when you were part of a union and working in a local factory. What really stood out to you in talking to those young people about who have this backdrop of what it used to be like and what their life is like now?
Well, you know, there was one guy I talked to who had a really interesting take in the sense that he spoke exactly in the way you're talking about how, you know, once upon a time, life in Kenosha might have been much easier for a youngish male. I'm 33. He was somewhere around that age himself, you know, trying to make a life and a family at this kind of key time in your life. He had this very rosy view of how Kenosha had been once upon a time. But interestingly, he actually was in a union. And something that had happened with him, I think, mirrors something that's happened both with unions and maybe with government in America in certain ways, where you strip away the functions and the power of it to do good in people's lives, and they stop believing in it, right? So he was in the tin workers union, but he was like, ah, it's just a way for people to get advancement. And, you know, he worked down in Illinois and he was just like, those people are all just corrupt, which I know nothing about. But it was interesting that that was his perspective. He didn't see the union as something that sort of stitched him into a broader labor movement anymore. And I think that that's something that a lot of people who, you know, work in this country and are worried about their futures, their retirements, their health benefits, all these things, we've sort of lost the sense of being a part of a greater movement.
We're talking with James Pogue right now. He's a contributor to Harper's Magazine and author of the August cover story titled "The Art of Losing: Can Democrats Win Back Post-Industrial America?" And you point out that, you know, no big surprise, our politics get talked about and assumed to be very polarized, that they're driven by anger, with really entrenched, passionate people on both sides. And while there's certainly an element of truth to that, and you can find those people, that's not the whole story of what you encountered in Kenosha. Can you talk a little bit about the general mood around politics and partisanship that you saw there?
Yeah, you know, I mean, and I mentioned in the story that I'm as guilty as anyone of this. And, you know, part of that is because so much of reporting on politics in this country today involves reporting on people who seem quite extreme, right? And reporting on people who are driving politics at the margins. And, you know, that can be of great interest. You know, I followed the Bernie Sanders campaign with a lot of interest because I felt like it was inspiring people from outside the, you know, normal political realms, as indeed Trump did. But then there's a lot of people who I think are, would be better described as sort of unconvinced that politics even affects their lives at all, and unconvinced that there is any vehicle whatsoever for politics for them anymore. And again, that goes back to a little bit of what we were talking about with unions, where people have sort of stopped believing in these structural and societal forces having any ability to work a good change for them in their lives and in the broader political sphere. And so it was interesting in Kenosha because you had a certain number of people who were very passionate on either side. We had a lot of people who were just sort of confused about why they should support one person, why Democrats are so alarmed by Trump. I heard over and over a lot of people sort of earnestly asking me why I thought Democrats thought Trump was so evil. And of course, I don't have an answer for that. But it was just interesting to hear over and over a sort of perplexity at that question. These weren't diehard Trump people. These were genuinely confused people, which was interesting.
There have certainly been some major changes over the years in places like Kenosha and Kenosha itself, but there are still jobs to be had. And some people you talked to described it as, you know, a pretty lively and vibrant place. That doesn't fit into the narrative of working class anger and resentment that has been really, you know, so dominant in the stories that have been told in the last 4 years.
No, and indeed, and the kind of plain speaking answer for that is, you know, a lot of people have just told the story wrong. You know, the Trump revolution, in addition to Brexit, in addition to elections in Italy and Hungary and other places, have been in large part bourgeois revolutions. That's not, you know, that's not a negative designation or anything. It's just, if you look at the actual numbers, a lot of the people who have been really taken by Trump are people who had very good lives, say, in the 1970s, and who sort of imagined that America kind of hit its peak then and are angry at changes that have happened since. Is that the same thing as the desperation and the working class anger and the, you know, the even the xenophobia that oftentimes is described as being the primary driver of the Trump movement? It overlaps with all of those, but I don't think it's the same thing. So, you know, in Kenosha, you had, at the time of Trump's election, you had some of the fastest job growth in the Kenosha sort of micropolitan area of anywhere in the country. So it wasn't people who didn't have jobs. It was people who felt, on some level, at least according to what I was hearing, it was people who felt a kind of deeper alienation from our broader politics and who saw in Trump a sort of movement to join. And they were very excited about that. It was a way of reconnecting with a belief in America and a belief in an American project. Whether you like that project or not, that's a different thing. But that was sort of how his appeal worked.
So there are obviously nuances to the story that I think both a lot of politicians and a lot of journalists are getting wrong or ignoring. Is there a chance that it's because the reality, that nuanced reality, doesn't fit into kind of the simple narrative that they expect or maybe want to find?
Well, I would step a little bit farther back from that. I mean, I definitely agree with those words, but I think it's even a bigger problem because we have a sort of, we had for a long time in this country, until Trump sort of shattered it, a kind of technocratic consensus that sort of existed since the fall of the Soviet Union, that progressive or globalization and technocratic governance and all these sorts of things were going to solve problems in a way that would lift all boats and that would bring us sort of inevitably towards this kind of, you know, perfect system. It was sort of this era that we were living in where the long tail of the end of history. And all of a sudden, it turns out that a lot of people felt left behind by that. A lot of people didn't think that the way of life that we've built in the last 35 years was a very desirable, enjoyable, or workable way of doing things. And quite frankly, Democrats are as guilty as anyone of ignoring those sentiments. And, you know, again, Kenosha becomes a really good example of that because Kenosha is a place that was really buffeted by American trade policy. And Democratic politicians, from Bill Clinton to Barack Obama to, you know, way on down the line, kind of told everyone, listen, just play ball on trade and everyone's life will get better because trade will lift all the boats in America. And I think a lot of people just fundamentally don't believe that and didn't believe that trade did improve their lives, but also were told by Democrats, hey, you don't have a choice about this. This is the way the world is going. And that caused an alienation.
We're talking with James Pogue right now. He's a contributor to Harper's Magazine and author of the August cover story titled The Art of Losing: Can Democrats Win Back Post-Industrial America? You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're from Kenosha or the southeastern part of the state, how do you feel about your local economy and your local way of life? What have changes in the labor landscape over the years meant for your political outlook? And wherever you are in the state, do you feel passionate about any political message out there right now? Or are you still looking for something that would really inspire you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue this conversation here on Central Time after this short break. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with James Pogue of Harper's Magazine about his 6 weeks of reporting from Kenosha County, looking at how people there feel about politics and what they want to hear from those running for office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're from Kenosha or near the state line area, how do you feel about life in your community and its economy? Do you think deindustrialization has changed the political mood of your city or town? And wherever you are in Wisconsin, are you feeling excited about politics or maybe a bit exhausted? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. And James, historically, places like Kenosha, Racine, Janesville were strongholds for the Democratic Party, but a lot of folks there, including former union workers, now lean Republican. Is there a sense that Democrats fell down on the job somewhere along the way?
Well, you know, I put that question to the mayor of Kenosha, and he had a really interesting two-part answer, where on the first hand, you know, he said basically, hey, it's really simple. Democrats ignored the southeastern part of the state, and Democrats nationally ignored Wisconsin, which I think is quite true. Then he had he sort of paused and had a follow-up to that, where he said that a lot of people he knew no longer felt, and he paused and he said, apart. And it was interesting to try to understand what he meant, because I felt like I did understand, but he meant that people didn't feel a part of civic life, and they didn't feel a part of politics more broadly, and they didn't feel a part of an American project that was sort of about making their lives better and about making the country better anymore. They felt, you know, hey, there might be polarization and there might be a team that some people are on, but where do I fall and why does any of this matter? And I do think that Democrats have very much fallen down on the job in that regard, in the sense of like, hey, once upon a time, Democrats in this part of the country that we're talking about were very associated with working for the rights of working people. As that changed, and as they didn't prove to be as interested in that as they had ever claimed, what replaced it? And again, Democrats have not really wrestled with that question. And when they have wrestled with it, as in, you know, sort of the 2016 and 2020 primaries, they've mostly come down on this thing of, hey, we need to focus on electability, with the result that more and more people remain sort of alienated and confused about what the Democratic Party actually stands for. And at some point, at least in my opinion, they are going to have to figure out an answer to that.
We're talking with James Pogue about his cover story for Harper's Magazine titled The Art of Losing: Can Democrats Win Back Post-Industrial America? You can join in at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones. Joan is in Eau Claire. Hi, Joan.
Good afternoon. What I feel passionately about is that in Wisconsin, we have not had a fair election since 2009. 2010 election, after that time, we had our legislators making these very gerrymandered districts in the state. And at the current time, there's no chance for a Democratic candidate to make any kind of headway in a Republican gerrymandered district. When the U.S. Supreme Court refused to take the case with the gerrymandering with regard to Wisconsin, I said to my friends and colleagues, democracy died today. I would like to see these Republicans in the Wisconsin legislature, Senate and House, to have a really meaningful conversation and have some meaningful work on redistricting that does not involve gerrymandering. And to this point, I have seen nothing of the kind come from these Republicans. And thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you for the call, Joan. And James, I'm curious, did the issue of redistricting and gerrymandering come up at all when you were talking with people?
You know, absolutely. Obviously, that's such a huge issue in Wisconsin. And, you know, candidly, the reason that it has become such a massive issue in Wisconsin is because Wisconsin Republicans, since the beginning of the Walker era, really played to win. And they played to win very, very hard. And they pushed these very, very big sort of like principle kind of ideas. And, you know, I can maybe disagree with whether or not I liked any of that. But as a method of politics, it turned out to be wildly and almost dangerously effective, right? And so a little bit of what comes across in the piece, I would think, is that, you know, in order to counteract that, just as on a national level, you kind of have to have a landslide election to win back the House. One party or another has to have a big sweep. That may start playing out in other smaller areas, you know, on state levels as well, as this gerrymandering becomes a bigger issue.
James, did people tell you, were they able to articulate what kind of candidate or message would really excite them and make them feel more invested in politics? And going back to something you said earlier, feel like politics actually means something in their lives?
Well, you know, and I mentioned this in the piece, and, you know, I hope this doesn't make anyone doubt the general objectivity of my work here. But, you know, I was very in the tank for Bernie Sanders, for the reason that I thought he was the kind of person who would really excite people who hadn't been in politics before and who would really get people into this kind of new vision of building an American project. Candidly, that didn't really work out because people in Kenosha who were, you know, very invested in the Democratic Party were really interested in getting rid of Trump, right? And so, you know, on the Democratic side, you had a lot of people who really, really, that was their biggest priority. And I think that's totally understandable. But it leaves open the question of what is a candidate for president who's a Democrat going to do when there isn't a foil of someone like Trump, when it isn't reactive? What is the broader vision of the Democratic Party? And really, no one had much of an idea. And I wouldn't say that I do either, honestly. But, you know, that's sort of the big lacuna in our politics right now.
And briefly, in our last half minute, a lot has happened in the months since you left Wisconsin in February, still a few months before the election. Do you think Joe Biden has the potential to win back places like Kenosha County?
You know, I don't do predictions, of course. I think obviously it looks a lot like he's going to now. But, you know, again, our elections are really about enthusiasm and buy-in. And Democrats are very enthused right now, but there's a lot that can happen and there's a lot that can sort of suck that out because Biden is a reactive candidate. Biden is a candidate of non-Trump. And unless he finds some way to shore that up, any little misstep could cause that to fall away.
And is it significant that the DNC, which was going to be in southeastern Wisconsin, is going to be virtual? Do you think that that would have given more of a bump to Democrats by saying, hey, we're here and we care?
You know, I'm maybe just conjecturing, but I think a lot of Democrats are happy that that Wisconsin has gotten as much attention as it already has. I think people do feel like it's getting the attention now. I think that's going to be a little less of an issue. But, you know, I'm not from Wisconsin, so I can't really speak to it.
Well, James, thank you so much for joining us, and it's a really interesting piece.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
James Pogue is a contributor to Harper's Magazine. He talked with us about his latest cover story for Harper's. It's The Art of Losing. Can Democrats Win Back Post-Industrial America? You can find a link to that at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up Monday on Central Time, while in recent months it may have been overshadowed by other issues, the opioid crisis is still raging. We talk with an NPR journalist who has found high prescribing levels among doctors and dentists. And if your sense of time seems off in the past few months, you are not alone. We'll find out why living in the time of COVID has messed that up. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9, it's The Morning Show. Monday after 7, access to reliable and affordable high-speed internet is more important than ever. Kate Archer-Kent talks with the head of a task force recently formed by the Evers administration, and they'll welcome your questions and comments. That's coming up Monday at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about how to make the perfect summer drink in this week's edition of Food Friday. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.